Okay, so yeah, I'm not a, all right, so I'm not exactly, I'll be honest, I wasn't exactly sure what I was supposed to do as the moderator, other than moderate. So, I don't know, I guess maybe we can just start with one of the articles. I didn't know if anybody had a preference over which one we started with. Did anybody like either one better? Anybody have a preference? Shaughnessy or Connell?
I like the Connell better, personally. But
all right. Yeah, the Connell, I think, was a little easier to go through. I personally just thought. Shaughnessy was a little dense. It just had a lot in it.
Yeah,
okay,
it did.
So I just thought, you know, just as kind of a way to get started, we could just kind of all say, I don't know, just some things that jumped out at us. I mean, I know there were several things, even though they were talking a lot about K-12 studies that were done, I know there's a lot of things that sort of jumped out at me that were like, you know, wow, okay, I've seen that with my own students. Of course, I do a lot with math education, K-12 stuff too, so I do have a little bit of crossover there. So I just a couple of things that, like, jumped out at me just to kind of get us started. They said something about students not trusting the sample to estimate the population. There was a whole thing somewhere in here, and I was like, you know, just the whole crux of, you know, what we do as statisticians, and students just still not trusting that when we take a sample, that that's actually okay to use that to estimate things in the population. So I thought that was really interesting that they had found that and in some of the work that they had done. So that was one thing. Another one that jumped out at me was the idea that they still were having trouble sort of aggregating things in a group, talking about data points as a group. They still wanted to sort of point to individual data points. And there was a whole thing about how students, even if they had taken the labels off the data, they still remembered, like, that their data point was what, that particular one on the graph and they put it on the board. So I thought that was really interesting. So they're having trouble sort of looking at the data as a group and sort of pulling themselves out of it and not looking at each individual data point. So we could talk about that a little bit. Let's see. I'm trying to look through my list here. I remember we were talking about language at USCOTS, and there was something about language with the average. There was a whole section that kind of jumped out at me because we'd been talking about language before. And then something about averages with different sample sizes, and I'm not remembering why I wrote that down, but that kind of jumped out at me. They did some work with looking at people not being able to deal with averages with different sample sizes. So I don't know if somebody wanted to say something about any of that, or just other things that jumped out at people from the Connell article. So, anyone?
Well, this is Herla. I know that I kind of agree with a lot of you said. That's sort of the stuff that I highlighted when I was going through. Definitely the part about students not trusting samples, since we had expressed interest in that at USCOTS. You know, do students know why we do inference? I also thought it was interesting when they talked about comparing groups, which is so central to inference, or such an important aspect of interest is the ability to compare groups, that he said that even students who will use the average to describe a single sample, they don't then think of the average as a way to compare samples. So they think of averages as just a description, but not necessarily really representative of an entire group, that maybe it only applies to those people that are close to the value, or whose data points are close to the value. So I also thought that part was kind of interesting, is how, you know, not only are students sort of distrusting of the idea of taking a sample to represent a population, but then even within that, they're distrusting of using a single number to represent the sample and all of the values in the sample. So that was an additional point that stood out to me.
Did anybody, Tara, Jackie, did you guys, did that jump out at you at all?
The one thing that jumped out at me the most was the the recipe approach to data analysis. I think that's something I see a lot when a lot of the topics I cover, they just want me to give them a list of steps to follow. They don't want to try to reason through and mm-hmm. figure out, like, which test they need to use, or they want a recipe that they can follow.
Yeah.
And they talked about that a couple of different places. They become so immersed in following the process that they can't step back and look at a connection between that and the situation that they're actually studying, what the data represents in the real world.
So this is Holly Lynn. Related to that last point, either from the reading or from just kind of your own intuitions, any hypotheses about why students might like this recipe approach better, why they want this?
It's what they get in traditional math. They get steps that they have to follow to solve a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I also think students, like, you know, they're ultimately interested in their grade. And I think a recipe approach seems easier because it seems more like there's right or wrong steps in the recipe that will lead to a consistent outcome, which is then right or wrong.
Uh-huh.
Whereas if you're using context, that introduces a little bit of kind of subjectivity back into the data, because they're no longer just numbers, they're numbers within a context, and the same numbers in different contexts may have different meanings or different connotations behind them. So I think some of it is that kind of uncomfort with ambiguity. There was a poster at UFCOTS about that students don't like the ambiguity that goes with data analysis, and I think an algorithm removes some of that.
Go ahead.
Sorry, this is Jackie. I was just going to say that I kind of agree with that, too, just because when you set the alpha level for the students, they're much happier than if they have to decide what alpha should be in the first place, because that kind of, you know, gives them that cutoff point instead of having to make them think about, well, you know, at what point is something a small enough probability to be actually concerned about it?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of, you know, students want us to kind of tell them, you know, what is the right way to do it. And I think part of it is, you know, just wanting to have a good grade, just wanting to know, you know, what do we have to do. But I know just from working with some of my developmental students in the last couple of years that there is, you know, I had talked to so many students who in K through 12, you know, they're punished if they don't do it in a certain step-by-step process. So I think there's also, you know, a learned response that if it isn't done in a certain step-by-step process, that they're going to be wrong.
Right.
And so when we're talking about something where there is lots of different ways to do it or lots of different ways to think about it, they're very, very uncomfortable with it. So I think it is partly, you know, a grade type of thing, but I think it's also just a learned response that somebody said just a couple minutes ago about, you know, that's what they do in mathematics. And it is, you know, they run into teachers who I think themselves are uncomfortable with doing mathematics problems in a variety of ways and with a variety of approaches and thinking conceptually. And so students have learned that, you know, you either do it this way and you do it with a step-by-step process or you're wrong, even if they end up with the right answer or with the right reasoning. And it's been very frustrating trying to deal with those students at the college level, because then, you know, I'm trying to get them, you know, it's to the point where, like, if I get an answer like -1/2 and I have, you know, 1/-2, and they're like, is that right? Is that the same thing? I mean, it's so bad that they can't even look at something that's just even slightly different and be comfortable with the fact that that's the right answer. So, I mean, that's not really in statistics, but, you know, there are some students that are that far stressed out about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and
so,
chime in here. This is Holly Lynn. Chime in here, you know, about this issue. But I mean, in math education, I think for at least the last 20 years, we've been trying to move mathematics at the K-12 school level to look differently, and you know, with not always great success. I think you're right that we still have lots of teachers out there that are very much more comfortable in this kind of recipe approach to their classrooms.
but it's something that we're struggling with. But I had an interesting conversation with some STEPS professors here at NC State, and you know, talking about this. And I mean, they were very quick to say that the problem doesn't just lie in the way that mathematics is taught, that there are just as many statistics professors that teach in a very recipe approach as well.
Mm-hmm.
That it's not necessarily that, oh, it's the mathematicians over there that are doing it that way, that, you know, that it happens in statistics as well. So I think in stats education, it's, you know, we're trying to move away from that, but I think we're up against the same struggles as the math education community has been dealing with for a couple decades now.
Yeah.
All right, this is Jackie. I guess compared to what everyone else has said about the paper, the only one thing I think I would need to add is about the whole random sample, about how students really do not trust a random sample. And I don't know if it's that word random, when you think about random as being a kind of off-kilter or off-key, just came out of nowhere kind of idea, something being random, if that's the reasoning that they're not trusting a random sample of being like, oh, there's no rhyme or reason to it, it's just random.
Yeah, and I think they did say something about that somewhere in the article, that there was sort of a progression of some of the things they identified as they thought were problems, and I'm having trouble finding it right now. Maybe somebody else knows what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I was just trying to look for it, too. This is probably when.
Yeah.
Where it is.
Because they went through a progression of how students kind of thought about sample.
This is Herla, and I remember in the Shaughnessy article, they mentioned it in both articles that actually came up. I think that's why it stuck out. They talked about how students really like this idea of fairness in sampling.
Mm-hmm.
And how they're concerned,
yeah,
like a random sample wouldn't be fair. And that connects, you know, also back to the idea of them not trusting a sample to represent a population. They really want to see everyone, because that's
right.
The only way to
yeah.
get everyone's opinions represented. Or
yeah, no,
and that actually brings out, too, it can be different the way they think about survey contexts versus just drawing marbles out of an urn. There was a study I was reading the other day where students would trust a random sample if it was drawn from, you know, marbles from an urn context, but then with the surveying context, they didn't think a random sample was fair because in their view, not everyone had the option to participate, so that became an important part of the surveying context, whereas it wasn't in the cleaner context, I guess, of drawing marbles.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember who wrote that article, Randy?
Yeah, it was a book published in 1998, Reflections on Teaching, or I guess it's just Reflections on Statistics. And I think it was, let's see, I have the book here. I'll look it up.
Okay.
I should have it in
It's
a couple
related
minutes.
Personally to some of the things that I'm working on, so that was a tangent.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I'll find it in a minute.
Okay.
So please carry on while I'm looking it up.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if this is exactly what I was looking for, but they do talk in the Connell article. I do like that they talk a little bit about the fact that students were actually able to figure out the ideas of, like, stratified sampling on their own without, because they were talking about how they were trying to estimate the gender of the makeup of the school, and the sixth graders wanted a fair split scheme where they sampled 25 boys and 25 girls, which I thought was kind of funny. But then they, you know, the methods they endorsed included randomization and stratified randomization techniques. Example, they favored sampling from a population of school students by randomly selecting 5 girls and 5 boys from each grade, because that way they'd have a mixture of boys and girls who were different ages, because sometimes girls and boys have different opinions on things, and also one age might really like something, but an older age might think that was a terrible idea. But they had, so, you know, they were, you know, these 4th, 5th, and 6th graders were, like, getting at the idea of, you know, different ages. It might be important to have different ages in your sample because they might have different opinions. So I thought that was really interesting. And those were things they came up with on their own.
Right.
So that was one of the things. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Very natural for a lot of students to and this I think this is one of the points that's being made, to be very concerned with fairness. That comes up in the literature on probability learning a lot as well. And, you know, related back to just ideas of in their own life, you know, they're very concerned in a very egocentric way of what's fair to them. And so they bring this, you know, bring this forward to their work in data analysis and statistics. So have any of you experienced this level of concern about fairness and not really trusting kind of random samples at the collegiate level?
At the collegiate level, in the class that I just taught at Michigan, we really didn't address sampling at all. We worked with all pre-canned data sets, so it never came up as an issue.
Uh-huh.
They never had to think about where the data came from, except, you know, once or twice when I wanted to point out really obvious confounders and things.
Right.
But it was never really an issue that I came across.
Yeah, and I certainly have heard lots of people talk about that if we always use kind of pre-canned data, then there's a whole part of the kind of exploratory data analysis cycle that they're not getting exposed to, you know, about this idea of asking a question and how the data that that they need to collect and what measures would help them to answer a question and how to figure out how to sample.
I know that when I start hypothesis testing and I sort of do a couple informal problems and I give them a result where one sample result is way different from, you know, what the expected result is, and I say, all right, so what's some possible conclusions here? Invariably, the first response is it was a bad sample. Like, that's just always the first response. It's never that, oh, well, maybe something interesting is going on here, or, you know, the assumptions are wrong, or, you know, and even as we get into hypothesis testing, as I've talked about it a little bit, it's always the sample's bad. It's just, you know, so that's why I really was interested in sort of not trusting the sample, that whole idea. It's not that I really spend a whole lot on time on sampling. I talk a little bit about sampling methods before we get to hypothesis testing, but you know, I just don't really have the time to do a whole lot, at least in the course that I was in. I'm going to try and change that next year. But
I think that it brings up just the point that you were making there of this idea of students having a very kind of different levels of tolerance for variability from an expected, and that some students really, you know, they really believe that every sample that I should get should look very much like what I, or in a large sample, you know, some students then expecting, because they think of this idea of kind of random meaning haphazard, that and anything can happen, that they that some of them also have high tolerance for variation, that variation that's they expect variation that too much variation that really should not occur. So I've seen both of those issues.
Yeah. Yeah. And that point too, I think it was in the Shaughnessy article as well,
huh?
That there's a Shaughnessy was talking about the balance between knowing everything from a sample and knowing nothing from a sample, and, you know, students falling on both ends of the spectrum.
Yeah.
And the other point too that you made that was in his article was the idea of students not getting a chance to form questions and really just experiencing, I think he called it like an impoverished exploratory cycle.
Yeah.
So they also bring that baggage with them from other classes and things like that. So.
Yeah, no, the Shaughnessy was talking about the whole cycle, the PPCC, I don't remember the letters.
PPCC.
Thank you. But yeah, that actually really hit home with me, the fact that the two like most important things, because, you know, I think all of us have probably, you know, done some serious statistical work where we've all had to struggle with data and, you know, collecting it and all the rest of it. And yeah, our students never go through that. So I just, that kind of hit home with me as well.
I think it's very similar to mistakes that are often made in math classrooms, where in math classrooms, the application problems are always at the end of the chapter. And if you're running out of time, you don't get to them. And so
yeah.
This is really important aspect of doing mathematics that really gets kind of left out. And, you know, in statistics, if we never really let them experience this beginning part of where the data comes from in the first place,
yeah,
they're missing a really important part. Could be, you know, it could be contributing to some of these misunderstandings of ideas of sampling and how.
Yeah, and this.
So go ahead.
I was just gonna say this is a really small point, but I just made a note of it, and not necessarily a research area. But I know that personally, one of the big things I have trouble with is when I get to the part where I actually have them do student projects, because I don't have time to show them how to put data into the computer. They don't even know how to, like, put data, you know, how to, like, stack data in a mini-tab sheet or an Excel. And it's just amazing to me that, like, they don't know how to, and it's, you know, just sort of a basic thing about putting data into a computer that it just amazes me that that's, or like the different types of data and how that actually looks into a something I take for granted because, you know, I just put it in the computer and I know how to do the different forms of data. So, but there was something he said about different formats off the web of data.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that you really have to be, that's like another form of statistical literacy at this point, is being able to pull data off the website and being able to plow through it and being able to format it correctly so that you can actually use it.
Right.
That's when that, like, I put a little note next to that.
Yeah, I always call that
in the Shaughnessy article.
Yeah, the data grunge work.
Yeah. But I know that I have, I mean, it's something I have a trouble with my students because, you know, even I have trouble pulling stuff off the web and figuring out what exactly they've done to it sometimes. So, anyway. So was there anything else with the Connell Dart? Jackie, Tara, kind of quiet. So did you have anything else that you guys wanted to say about that one?
The only thing that I had was on page 3, they talked about how they didn't include any literature related to statistical inferencing because they would also have to do the development and probabilistic thinking.
Yeah, I think I made a note of that too because we talked about statistical inference. So
what does that imply about you all's interest in statistical inference?
Well, I think it means that there's lots of, I mean, it's statistical inference is such a huge area. But that's good. I think that means there's lots of places that we could, you know, find some interesting questions.
Right.
So.
Yeah, I think if we were to focus more on the issue of do students even understand kind of what inference is, this idea of going from the population to the sample back to the population, and do they understand why we're doing it, I think that might be, yeah, that was something I remember, I think it was Lee who said it at ESCOTS at our final meeting. So that seems like it might be a more reasonable slice within the whole inference picture to try and tackle. Which I think wouldn't require so much of a you know, rigorous foundation in probability theory.
Yeah.
I think that line just hit home for me because we really don't do much with probability at all in our statistics class. We don't do a whole lot.
Yeah,
just with the basic probability rules and stuff. So I'm thinking we're expecting them to be able to do statistical inferencing, but if we've never done a chapter on basic probability, are they really going to be able to do statistical inferencing?
I think it depends on what the chapter includes. You know, we did We did a chapter on probability where we started with they had to define the sample space and they had to define various events. You know, if you drop a carton of eggs and the event A is the event that six eggs break and B is the event that at least two eggs break. And we looked at intersections and unions and Venn diagrams and we did, you know, probability for the sake of probability. And I'm really not convinced that was helpful when it came to inference and p-values.
See, that's what we just had a big argument about this. We have some new people who are teaching who said that we have to do that because they can't do inferencing without it. And we just added probability in, but that takes away from the time we have to do other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, but they insisted that they did a whole big unit on probability. They spent like 2.5 weeks on probability and that it helped their students really understand when they got to inferencing. So.
Well, that's interesting because I think there is a huge, at least there's a huge segment within the stat ed community that probability really should be sort of phased out. I mean, that's
right.
One of the things that we could let go of in place of more conceptual type of ideas. I mean, because they're saying, you know, we got so much packed into this course, what can we let go of? And sort of that
right.
Basic probability, some people say that, you know, that's one of the things we can let go of. So that's interesting.
I think it goes back to the point that was made earlier, and I actually was sitting in on and participating in a session with Roxy Peck, and she had different people debating what could be let go in the statistics courses, and one of it was, could you let go of the probability section? And people were making arguments pro and con, and I think... And this is something that certainly related to a lot of my own research. It depends on what you mean by basic probability. And I think one of you was making that point earlier. It depends on the way that you approach probability as far as is it going to be supportive and useful for inference making. I mean, if it's only a combinatorial type of approach, it's that where all the problems you have a known distribution, then there's nothing that you're really making inferences about. But if you're faced with situations where there's an unknown distribution, or you're trying to find something out about the distribution, then perhaps those are the types of activities that could be supportive of developing a lens for doing sampling inference.
Yeah. I think it depends, too, not only on what type of probability you include, but then also how explicitly you connect probability back to inference. You know, what we did, we went through the whole unit on probability, then we introduced probability distributions, then we started introducing sampling distributions, confidence intervals, hypothesis tests. By the time we got to p-value, we referred to it as a probability, but we never really tried to connect it back too much more. We just kind of assumed students saw the connection. And I was thinking that was one thing that actually stuck out at me in one of the webinars. I think it was Bob and Marsha's webinar on setting this for learning. It said students don't always see those connections the way we do, and we have to really make those more explicit. So it seems to me this could be, you know, a research question in and of itself is what type of probability do students really need to better understand inference, in particular p-values?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point because I always think of probability sort of that weird little section we do toward the beginning of, you know, just sort of not that I think of it that way, but it sort of comes across that way as this weird little section that sort of pops up at about the third chapter, and then we go back to doing statistics.
Yeah.
You know, I think it comes across that way, whether I mean it to or not.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking about intersections and unions, and then we go back to confidence intervals, and it just, the connection's not clear. I don't think I do a particularly good job of letting my students see the connections. And,
I don't
I know
think
the book
I
use
either.
Yeah, I know the book I use doesn't do that. So,
does the emphasis on the probability, does that come from the more mathematical, theoretical statistics courses? Because, I mean, I'm just finishing up the theoretical statistics course now, where we did a lot on probability. Almost the entire semester was on probability. And we certainly use all of it when we moved into our hypothesis testing and stuff. I mean, we're using all of the probability stuff, but it's at a much higher level. I mean, you know, at a 600 level course, when we're looking at it theoretically, it makes sense. Is that where the perspective is coming from, that they need the probability to be able to do the basic inferencing? Does that make sense? Or is that just...
I would say, yeah, probably. I mean...
Yeah, I would say, yeah, too. I would, you know, like Lee was saying, it seems like this just kind of random chapter that comes up, and then we go back to doing statistics. I've gotten some senses just listening to various people talking about, you know, developing course descriptions for course catalogs and getting courses approved by the university, that there are some things that are just perceived have to be in there. And if you want something to fulfill like a quantitative requirement or a more mathematical requirement, you have to have probability in there because that's more mathematical than, say, pure statistics. You know, speaking in very gross generalizations, but I think there is still a bit of a residual sense of that, that, you know, at the higher level, you certainly need it for the math. It's when you're getting into the more mathematically rigorous and theoretical stuff, so it kind of has stuck around in the intro course for that same reason.
This is Jackie. For us, it seems like, and this is all, obviously, this is my first year at this university, but a lot of it was dependent upon almost the title of the class. Because I taught one class that was Introduction to Probability and Statistics, so obviously probability was in it. But another one I taught was just Intro to Statistical Methods, and so there was actually no probability taught other than the idea of what a probability close to zero meant versus a probability close to one. And that was all we taught in our intro level class.
Was one for more of your business majors and one for more of your math science majors?
No, one is elementary ed, and the rest is everyone's like the nursing, everything, business, everyone. Those don't even have probability in them.
So the one for the elementary school teachers, they don't have probability?
Yeah.
Oh.
It's in the Kentucky guidelines that they have to be able to teach some of that at the elementary level.
Oh, wait, so the elementary ed one has the probability?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
And the other ones don't.
The other
okay.
Way around.
I thought it was opposite.
Like, whoa. Okay. Interesting. Just to kind of, not to totally turn the conversation around or anything, was there anything on the Shaughnessy? I know the Shaughnessy article was a little longer. We've kind of touched on a couple of things. Was there anything out of the Shaughnessy article that anybody wanted to bring up?
Before we go to Shaughnessy, am I supposed to synthesize or something? I'm not really sure what I'm supposed to do.
Oh,
this is Tara.
The synthesizer.
I'm the synthesizer. Am I just supposed to summarize what we talked about in the last paper? Is that what my role is? Someone who's done this before?
I don't know. I mean, I guess that could be part of it. I think my impression of it is that it can be valuable if you, and I think that people kind of do this naturally, is see like common threads in what people are talking about. And I mean, you know, that could even lead up into some research questions, but I you know, it's kind of hard to have, I think, just one person do that because people tend to do it naturally in a conversation. But I mean, I think we've had some of that, like tying together the interest in sampling, maybe how that connects to some of the K-12 stuff or the teaching strategies, but that's kind of how I look at the synthesizer part of it.
Okay.
The only thing I wanted to mention out of the Shaughnessy article, I just thought it was interesting. He talked a lot about how little has been done with teacher stuff, focusing on how teachers... what teachers know about, and I guess I'm just interested in that because I'm, you know, going into a math ed position, and just how little research has been done on their understanding. And I guess he made it sound, and maybe this is just my impression, that it's difficult to get a handle on what they understand and what they don't understand, and I guess I found that interesting why he said that. I wasn't
really
sure why.
Want to admit that they don't know it?
Yeah, and I wasn't, because I guess maybe that hasn't necessarily been my experience with teachers that I've talked to. Because I've been to a couple of professional development, and I mean, most of the teachers I've talked to, I mean, they really want to know, you know. They would like professional development statistics. They're frustrated that they don't have the background that they should have in statistics. So, yeah, I was kind of interested to see what he had to say about teachers. Other than that, I didn't really have... I don't know. Does anybody else have any experience?
Yeah, I think related to the issue with teachers is it certainly has been my experience that that most teachers do want to learn more about province staff, but it also seems to be the thing that they fear the most. That because they recognize whether they're going to admit it or not, they recognize that it is an area that they feel the least prepared in. And so they kind of just get very, very scared about the whole thing. And especially if it's approached in more of an exploratory data analysis type of way, it often goes against their comfort recipe getting approach to teaching and learning. So, it really is kind of messy for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So a lot of times when they first start teaching statistics, it often looks like very traditional math instruction. I do think that they struggle with it, and that the concepts are hard. And it's not, unfortunately, depending on what state they're in, it's more or less part of the curriculum that they have to teach. So some of them feel that they can avoid it if they just always teach Algebra 1 and Algebra 2. They may be asked to do very minimal things related to statistics if they teach those classes. And others openly embrace, I want to be the next AP Stats teacher in my school. So I really want to learn this. I see this as an opportunity to do something different. I think the reactions to it vary greatly.
Yeah. Well, I suppose if you're at a professional development thing for statistics, you really want to be there. So.
Right.
Yeah.
If you do it in undergrad teacher education, where they have no choice but to be in your methods class, is where you see this range of reactions.
Okay. Yeah. Any other comments on teachers' understanding? Which I guess, could sort of be generalized to college teachers, too.
I was going to say, I think that's true, because I think a lot of times when statistics is being taught in the math department, and it's not a separate department by itself, but a lot of times people kind of get stuck with the class and they don't really want to teach it. And we have that problem. We're a really small college, but we have tons of statistics sections, and we have a lot of people who have to teach the class who don't want to teach the class.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't really feel comfortable with the material, but they don't have any choice because they're supposed to be able to teach any math, and that's part of our math curriculum. So I think it applies to college level also, at least in my experience.
Do you think that they would resist, how do I want to put this, do you think if they were questioned on their understanding, not, I want to say question's the wrong word, but, if somebody tried to research their understanding, do they think that they would have sort of the same reaction that Shaughnessy was talking about?
Oh,
they would resist that?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. All right. I mean, I know a few of my colleagues would probably resist that very strongly. So.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead. I was just going to say that it's been kind of an area of interest for me because I've been at a couple different colleges where, the people who've been teaching statistics are so wildly different and their styles are so wildly different that it's one of the things I would really like to sort of do some sort of research on the different teachers of statistics, but I'm not really sure how I would go about that because I think any research that sort of assess their understanding of the concepts, I think that's kind of a, it is kind of a tricky little wire to walk, you know, in terms of not insulting them and not, you know.
Right. And so, I mean, I think that there'd be a lot, this is Holly Lynn, there'd be a lot to learn from literature, because certainly many, many, many math educators actually study teacher education. And so it's not necessarily, so there have been studies studying math teacher educators. I'm actually involved in work right now trying to study the work of math teacher educators, to study their understanding of probability and statistics and the way that they are going to be using some of the materials that a group of us here at NC State have written for. We've written teacher education materials for teaching data and probability with technology. And so we're going into this phase of trying to disseminate it, and we recognize the need for faculty professional development to get them kind of ramped up, because it's an area for math teacher educators that they know very little about. So it's not just our math teachers, but math teacher educators haven't spent a whole lot of time thinking about probability. And they're the primary ones charged with teaching math teachers.
Well, yeah, I thought it was great. Shaughnessy said something about he ran into a colleague, a math education colleague, who's like, you know, so nothing's really going on in statistics, huh?
Yeah.
Somewhere in this article. He said something about that, and he was like, thought that was pretty funny.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry, didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, but so I think that there certainly are some techniques that can be used, and and some of the approaches can be very similar to approaches that you take in studying teachers, because even in studying teachers, you have to be careful not to insult them as well. I mean, you don't want to, you know, anytime that you're, so, you know, there's multiple layers of trying to do your research on participants so that they feel comfortable in the research rather than that they're being prodded.
Mm. Yeah.
I think it's the same is true with how you research your students.
Yeah. I just know that I have some colleagues who are a little more prickly about certain things. So.
Well, I think sometimes that happens because they're not necessarily in a context where they feel that they that they're in that they're doing something that's worthy of studying. But in the case of the work that we're doing, we're providing faculty professional development. Again, these are people who recognize I want to learn something about how to do something about data and probability. So it is very much of a selected sample.
Yeah.
Want to learn it, and so then they're not as adverse to letting us study it.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think some of the participants that I would want to participate the most would be the ones that would be the most resistant, because they don't see the value of any professional development in that area. So, which is frustrating. But anyway, sorry, that's just my own personal issues with.
Well, I think one technique for that, and I know this is still going off on a tangent, we can stop it in a minute, but is doing interviews with them where the kinds of questions that you're asking them are not just, I want you to solve this problem, but you ask them in a way that puts them in the context of their profession, and it helps you get at understanding through aging them in a task that they're used to doing, rather than saying, I want you to sit down and do a bunch of these problems for me. So there are more ways.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, we're totally off it.
Okay.
I'm supposed to be the moderator here, but taking us off on a tangent. Okay. So, anybody else have anything else from the Shaughnessy article jump out at anybody?
The one thing that jumped out at me, this is Tara, from that article was that they said when, I think it was this article, whenever people have tried to do research on statistical inferencing, that they always end up having to back up because there are so many other things that the students don't understand that lead into the statistical inferencing. And I think that's actually what we were ended up getting at, too, because the first article we ended up with all the sampling discussion. So if they don't understand sampling, they don't understand sampling distributions, then they're not going to be able to do the statistical inferencing. So I think that kind of struck me when I was reading the article, and it ended up being consistent with where our discussion went, the first part of the conference call. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's consistent with what the 07 cluster people found. I remember hearing some stories about, well, they wanted to study this, but then they realized, and I think the case was they wanted to study inference, but then they realized students needed to understand sampling distribution, so they had to back up to sampling distribution. And I'm sure you can back up even farther from that.
I think when Joan Garfield did her work with sampling distributions, you know, she did a whole series of studies with sampling distributions, with, like, sampling sim software. I think that's one of the things she said was that, you know, at the end of it, she realized that really they need to back up to distribution and the ideas of variability and center. And so, yeah, I mean, there's a whole, it's almost a never-ending cycle, you know. You can study the later things, but you always kind of come to the conclusion that really we need to go back and understand the stuff that comes before it. So, you know, I think you could almost drive yourself crazy, you know, trying to find the beginning, almost,
yeah,
if you know what I mean. But it is a problem because everything is so intertwined and so wrapped up in all the other concepts in statistics, trying to isolate one particular thing to study and not have it so interconnected with so many other topics, I think is frustrating or difficult. I don't want to say frustrating, but difficult to do.
Yeah.
So. But I do. I really like the idea of just maybe focusing in on the idea of, you know, what students believe about bulls and how they perceive that to, or how they think about that in relation to population and how they see the connection between the two or don't see the connection between the two, because that really is sort of the underlying idea to almost everything we do. So,
Going back to that idea near the beginning of the call, if you have your email open, I sent the reference out that I was mentioning earlier on how they look at sampling differently in different contexts. It's in a book, so it may or may not be easy to actually get a hold of. I guess I could, if anyone was interested in reading it, I could make a PDF and send it out too. I think that's probably, well, no, I guess that's fair use. I don't know if that's breaking any copyright law, but if anyone is interested in that one, I could send it out, or you might even possibly have the book in your library too, so just let me know if that's something that the group would like to read.
Yeah, I mean, I actually sent an email in response to what Randy did. I did have my email open and saw his email pop in. Lots of things from that long time ago, and just a nice kind of reminder of, you know, there's good stuff back in there. I need to go back and reread some things. So I definitely am going to, but I know that I have that book. Actually, I think it's on my office. I sent out a link to Pat Thompson's homepage where he posts a lot of the articles that he has written, him and his graduate students. And in the section in Shaughnessy's chapter where they were talking about applying issues with sampling distribution and leading up to sampling and sampling distribution leading up to inference, He and his grad students are referenced a lot. So if you're interested in looking at those original articles, which I would highly suggest, then you can find them and you can get them from his website.
Okay.
That's good.
Yeah, I'm looking at the website now. It's pretty extensive.
So here's an example of a math educator who has, you know, spent some significant amount of time over the last decade at least, really thinking about this issue. And he really is a big proponent of this idea of doing a conceptual analysis of a topic. And I'm hearing you all talk about that as far as you kind of have to, you know, unpack statistical inference as far as what is involved in really understanding this and what are the different conceptual entities that are going to go and, you know, have to kind of be in place in order to appropriately apply ideas for inference. And so I think in a few of his articles, he actually starts offering some conceptual analysis of the idea of I can think of one place where he does it for sampling distribution, but there may be some others. It's been a while since I've read some of those primary articles.
He actually has an article titled "Why Statistical Inference is Hard to Understand."
Yep, yep. And
I wouldn't
be. I think that one is under review.
Yeah. So there's no link to it.
No, there's no link to it. So I mean, I know Pat. I wouldn't mind emailing him and asking if he would mind me sharing it with the group.
Yeah, it seems like that might be a good article. Yeah. To read, given our direction here.
Yeah. I went back and I looked at the slides that Joan emailed to us, and one of the things we're supposed to do in this call is select 1 to 2 readings that everyone's supposed to read for our next meeting.
Uh-huh.
So that certainly sounds, based on what I think we're interested in, that one certainly sounds promising. And then I think the one that Randy sent out sounds kind of promising, too. Did anyone get a chance to look at the literature on the CAUSE website and find anything really interesting there?
I didn't look on the CAUSE website, but I was looking for an article for something else, and I found one that was from Education Research Review from 2007, and it was entitled Students' Misconceptions of Statistical Inference. A review of the empirical evidence from research on statistics education.
That sounds interesting.
And it seemed like he kind of broke down what's been done in the area of statistical inference. That was my impression. I kind of skimmed it. I haven't had a chance to read the whole thing. But
who was the author?
It's from Belgium. I can email it. I'm actually in my kitchen. I'm not in my office.
Sure.
But it was Sotos, S-O-T-O-S, Van Hoof.
Okay.
And it was from the Educational Research Review, the second one that was published in 2007.
Yeah, I think that sounds promising as well. I was looking at Pat's website, and I would highly suspect that the manuscript that we're interested in that they have submitted is very much based on his 2007. If you go further down to his list, he has a 2007 manuscript that is Intricacies of Statistical Inference and Teachers' Understandings of Them. And so that one is available on his website. But I am going to email him to see if he'd let us read this one that's under review.
Okay.
So should we peg those two articles to read, the article that Tara suggested, and then one of these two Thompson articles, if we can get a hold of the submitted one, if not the 2007?
Okay.
Any objections? Going once, going twice?
Do we just want to do those two, or do we want to try to also do the other?
I was going to say this other one, if the Schwartz Goldman that Randy sent around.
Right.
I don't know if we can get that one.
Well, you guys have time to do three. I don't start until September, so August I have totally off other than prepping. But you guys start earlier, right?
If I get my act together and actually get reading when I should be fine, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I have some time and I'll be alone at JSM when I can do some reading.
Oh, no you won't, because I'll be there and I'll be bugging you. So.
Okay. Well, see, we can read together then.
Oh, yeah, well, that'll go well.
Right.
Yeah, all right.
What about you, Jackie?
I'm just quiet because I'm trying to write.
Okay. Well, we're recording, so, you know, got to take mad notes.
Oh, they're not mad, believe you me.
Okay.
Of course, sometimes it takes more time to go back and actually listen to the conference again to take your notes.
Yeah. All right, so it sounds like we have some...
Well, why don't we say the first two, and then if you have time, maybe skim the third. We maybe make the short sort of a, I don't want to say optional, but because we could push that to the third conference call if everybody gets real, real busy. Does that make sense? Like, if you get to it, you get to it, but if we don't have time to get to it, we don't get to it.
I think that sounds reasonable. Certainly.
So, you know, okay. Try to get to it, but if we don't, we don't. I don't know. I don't know if that's a good way to go about it or not.
I can PDF that chapter and send it out by email.
Oh, that would be great.
That'd be great.
Yeah. Okay. So do we have a consensus on what we're doing for the next research call? We all good?
So one of the two Thompson articles.
We'll figure out. I guess we'll wait. Holly, then will we wait to hear from you to see if we can get the
more recent his email right now.
Okay. We'll just wait to see if we can get the more recent one. Did everybody get the email from me about Google Groups? We do have a Google Group.
Yes.
Yeah, so we could probably be putting some of the stuff up there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have the one that I was talking about. I actually downloaded it and... put it. I have it in PDF on my PC upstairs, I think, so I can email it or I can post it on the Google Group site.
How do we access the Google Group site? Stupid tech question. Did our group have, I'm not remembering, does our group have like a name or something?
I think I just called it research, hold on, let me, research cluster.
I remember.
Alright, yeah, group name research cluster 09. Literally the group homepage is groups. All right, I can just email this again to everybody, but it's groups.google.com/group/researchcluster09 with dashes between cluster and 09. But I'll send it around again to everybody here.
If we log in, it just comes up as being a group or a member, right? We can just click on it. I don't use Google often, but because we had to set up an account to access it, right?
Wait, say that again.
For the Google Groups, we had to set up an account to access it. So if we log into our account, it should just pop up and say that we're a member of that group, right?
Should. It says you're a member. I just logged into Google Groups. I got Dr. Groff, Holly Lindley, Jackie, Research Cluster 09, which is apparently me. I don't know why. And Tara. The only one I'm missing is Herla, I guess. Herla and
Felicity. Wait,
I joined.
I did.
You're a member. I have 5 members. You are not a member, Herla.
All right. I will have to work on the I.
You're apparently a member of some other research cluster, aren't you?
Apparently. I remember creating the account. It's possible I just forgot to join the group. That wouldn't really surprise me too much. Now I just have to try to remember which password I used when I created the account. That should be interesting.
Okay. And I honestly know about as much as you guys do. I literally just sort of followed the instructions to start the group, and that's about as much as I know. So I really am learning how to use it as you guys are learning how to use it. So, okay. So, yeah, it says we can upload some files. So if you guys have any trouble, I mean, I guess I started it, I have administrator access. So if you can't do anything, let me know, and I'll try to make sure that everybody can do everything. So... Okay. All right. Do we want to try and set a date for the next research call?
Of course. Ah, yes. That'd be a good idea.
Yeah. Which?
So the next call should take place by September 1st, I believe.
All right. Okay.
All right.
And when do you guys get back from JSN?
So I'm going to be back. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, no. I was just going to say JSN ends on the 6th of August.
Yeah, it's like next week or a week later or something, whatever. So it's pretty early.
This is Tara. I'm going to be gone the 12th through the 16th.
You okay? I start Capital, like, starting the, well, actually, I have orientation on the 21st, and then the 24th to the 28th, I have faculty stuff going on. I have no idea what I'm doing, so it's going to be a little hard for me to, I mean, I can schedule something, but I may end up having to change it, because they've, like, not given me my schedule that week at all, which has been very frustrating. I know that's very helpful.
Right.
I mean, I can schedule something that week, but I might have to email you guys. And
are we talking about the week of the 24th?
Yeah, the week of the 24th. I don't know if people are starting then, or if that's a bad week.
That's when my IT gene starts.
Okay. So maybe back it up a week?
Yeah, we could. Either that, or we could do the 31st. I mean, we all might be teaching then, but
Yeah, that's when my classes start. I could do it that day, but yeah, I'm pretty tight that day.
Well, the week of the 17th is. I think I start teaching. I think I would teach on the 20th that week, but it would be early in the morning. So I could do anything else that week or afternoon of the 20th.
Okay, because I was going to propose the 20th. But if you don't want to do it the day you teach, I would understand.
Doing it after I teach would be a good idea, because then I won't be totally freaked out about starting to teach.
This is Holly Lynn.
Okay. Did somebody say they weren't available the 20th?
I have to be done by 4 o'clock, so as long as it's early afternoon or mid-afternoon.
It could be. I think I teach... I teach 8:30 to 10, so anytime, let's say 11 to 4 would probably work then.
All right. How do we feel about maybe give you a little time to rest? How about 11 or 1? Like around the lunch.
Not during lunch, but on either side.
I'm assuming nobody really wants to meet during lunch, so.
Right.
Why don't we do 1 o'clock?
1 o'clock?
That sounds fine by me.
Any objections?
Any objections?
Yeah. Yeah, no, that works for me. I'm actually listening to all your schedules. I'm on sabbatical this semester, so I'm like, my schedule is pretty flexible.
And I'll be on sabbatical in the spring, so.
Nice.
All right, so we have a dream at 1 o'clock, Thursday the 20th of August. All right,
and we should have read... For sure, we should have read the article that Tara's going to email. And then we're going to read one of the Thompson articles. And if we have time, we'll try and read the article that Randy sent. Is that correct?
Yes. That is what we decided on. And we're sort of narrowing in on sampling, samples versus population, inference. That's sort of the general cloud we're looking at.
Yeah. Right.
I don't know.
Do we need to choose roles for next time?
Oh.
Are we supposed to change?
Oh, yeah. We'll definitely have to pick an organizer. Which organizing is really easy. You email Jean, and she emails you back with the phone number and the passcode, and then you call. Very, very easy job.
Do
we just shift one down to make life easier?
Yeah.
Wait,
that
means
we're
not going to fight.
Yeah,
what order were they in?
Yeah, well, I think the organizer was first, moderator was second. Who was third? Recorder or synthesizer?
Synthesizer. I just found it on the slide.
All right. Synthesizer's third. So that means, okay, and then recorder was fourth. So Hurley,
then,
you're now moderator.
Okay.
I'm now synthesizer. Jackie, you were recorder?
I am recorder.
You are recorder, so now you'll be organizer.
Okay.
All right. And then, Tara, you're now recorder.
Oh, okay.
Do you think it would be useful for the synthesizer, and Tara, you can object to this if you want, but do you think it would be useful for the synthesizer to take literally like 5 or 10 minutes, write up a couple line summary of what we talked about and post that on the Google Groups page so we have a little bit of kind of a running record of the big themes of the call? Maybe the recorder and the synthesizer can work together on that? I don't...
And I would think, like, maybe posting the assigned articles would probably be helpful, too.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, maybe once the recorder has her notes done, she can forward a copy to the synthesizer, and the synthesizer can, you know, I don't know. Whatever you want.
Maybe that would... I'm just thinking some way that wouldn't be too much work for any one person, but to just kind of keep a running record so we all remember.
Yeah.
So I'll let Tara and Jackie decide what they think is reasonable, and they can set the tone for the rest of the the rest of the call.
That's fine. How soon do you want it up, though? I have a final in my class on Monday. I have an assignment due at midnight tomorrow and a final on Monday, so is Tuesday okay?
Yeah, I think that would be fine. You know, sometime before the next call.
Okay.
Sometime before all is... It's all recorded, so it doesn't really matter. So,
yeah,
it's forgotten.
But like Holly Lynn said, it would be, you know, it's not always easy to go back and listen to the whole recording. So if we had a summary. I just know I lately have gotten very bad about remembering things. But if I have, like, a brief sentence down, that can really help jog my memory. That type of thing. And I think that might be useful.
And this is Jackie. When I do post the notes, some of you might want to let me know if you feel like you need more, because I guess I'm pretty good at putting things together succinctly, and so I might not give enough information. So if you need me to go back and listen to the recording again to get more detail, I'll gladly do that.
Okay. All right, sounds really good.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone.
All right.
Okay. Enjoy the rest of your summer.
Everybody.
Yeah.
The next couple weeks.
Yeah.
All right. See you guys in about a month.
Signing off. Bye.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.